With Inspire Podcast, we're dedicated to bringing you the latest research in medicine, dentistry, veterinary medicine, and everything in between, from both students and academics in a language everyone can understand.
If you want to get in touch, please email us at inspiredjournalpodcast@gmail.com. You can find our website at www.inspirestudentjournal.co.uk, where you can access original research and articles from students, or find out about how you can get involved.
Today I'm joined by my co-hosts Sam and Ellie. Hi guys, how's everyone been?
Yeah, I've been okay. I've sort of stopped placement last week, so I've just been revising, which is good because it's nice not to be on placement, but also it's revising, so it's really not that fun.
What about you, Sam?
I've been plagued by toothache for the past 2 days, and it's been, I don't know, you know, I was talking to like Ellie before about how there's just something about a toothache in particular, of all the kinds of pain that you can get, that just makes you particularly miserable. It just makes you just mope around. And I've just been like that for the past couple of days. Like, I had a really fun chemistry practical thing yesterday that was kind of like, felt a little bit like cooking meth. It wasn't, but we were like doing crystallographies. They were trying to refine some pure as possible crystals. And I thought I was going to really enjoy it. And I kind of was just like moping the whole time, just with a sore mouth. Yeah, it's not fun. I'm trying to figure out whether it's like a wisdom teeth problem. I feel like once your wisdom teeth come in, you understand why babies cry so much. Because Imagine like, you know, it hurts so much having like four teeth come in at once. Imagine having like a whole mouth of teeth come in at once. Like, you would cry all the time.
I'd cry so much.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I completely
can't hear them. But at least you're back in the labs. I mean, you get to do near, like...
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't even get to appreciate it because I was busy moping around the whole time. But thankfully, at the moment, it's kind of a bit better. So, anyway, while we might eventually get a dentist on the show to help me with my wisdom tooth pain, today's guest is instead here to relieve some of our pain with perhaps some optimism on COVID and give us some ideas about how we may look forward to tackling pandemics and pandemic disease in the future. Today we're joined by Professor Sunetra Gupta from Oxford University, who's here to talk to us about theoretical epidemiology. We also want to talk about global health and pandemics in general. So welcome, Sunetra.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
We'd like to kind of start with an icebreaker kind of question, just to get the ball rolling. So we were wondering, what is your favourite film that you've watched recently?
Favourite film that I've watched recently? A film I watched recently, rewatched, is a film about the Second World War called Au Revoir les Enfants by Louis Malle. And it's a very touching, it's not a, you know, it's a very simple on the surface film, just about some kids in a fairly rural location in France who, and, you know, some new boys join, or one new boy joins, and he's, they don't realise until a bit later that he's Jewish and that the schoolmaster is hiding him. And it's told from the perspective of a boy who's not Jewish. And it's a very touching, very beautiful, a very tender film. But yes, it's a good icebreaker question because I'm very passionate about cinema. In fact, when I was, even younger than you, I wanted to be make films. So I've always been, my father was a film critic. So.
Oh, wow. That's so cool. Do you do any sort of filmmaking or like amateur, I don't know, documentaries or anything at the moment? Or
no, I don't. I've never actually done any kind of filmmaking, I'm afraid to say.
I used to love it. I used to make loads of films when I was, right up until I think I started uni, and they didn't have a film society, and it was really sad. They didn't have a society that made films, which I thought was a bit strange. Like, considering Bristol's quite an arty...
Yes, that's odd, yes.
Yeah, because I was looking forward to it. I thought, yeah, I'll get into that, like, make the movies. But, yeah, that's cool.
Well, I think Sam's little sister and my daughter probably made lots of little movies.
Yeah, I remember. Back in, we were very film-oriented family. But actually,
well, that's true. You've come from a very filmy background.
Yeah, because my dad's kind of background quite a long time ago now, but he was very involved in TV stuff like that. But actually, a fun fact, topical, but something that none of you know about me is that I had a brief, extremely brief, showing in a Netflix show.
Which one?
Yeah. Sense 8. Have you heard of it?
Sense 8, yes!
Yeah.
That's a big one.
Yeah, so we can go mini story time here. But back when I was at Cambridge, I was like very into rowing, but not on the university level, on the college level. And I did tons of rowing before I got to Cambridge. So I mainly did like the coaching and the sort of admin stuff in my college boat club. But I was approached by an alumna who was looking for somebody to help the film crew of Sense8 find a location to, they wanted like an idyllic background shot of Cambridge and rowing, and so they could get some of the cast like talking in front of that. And so I helped them find a location. We ended up going up to Ely, to this nice estate. And yeah, I think if you look at, I can't remember what it's, I think it's the first episode of season 2, maybe they're in Cambridge, and it's maybe a third of a second, I don't know. We ended up not really making, because we took two boats out. I know, it's not bad. I think I haven't checked the credits to see if I made it in, but technically it was slightly more than just the role on the camera. It was also helping find the location and stuff, but
that was fun. Second of fame.
I know, that's my IMDb profile is building.
I'm afraid I've given up on that being a career option.
Well, you never know.
Mm. Yeah, it's never too late.
Let's never too late for anything.
No, it's never too late, but I think...
So, I think, some of us are certainly wondering, theoretical epidemiology sounds very interesting, but something that I don't think any of us really know about. I mean, epidemiology is one thing, but theoretical epidemiology, what is it?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, it's not a title I particularly like having, just because it is a bit sort of abstruse, and it's not clear what it means. The reason, first of all, you know, when a title had to be assigned to me, as it were, and what I do, we didn't go for epidemiology because you all know what epidemiology is at some level anyway, that it's quite a broad field. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, what I do isn't classical epidemiology, which is sort of more of a statistical science. So I came to this field from a background in ecology and evolution. And so my main focus is how we can apply ecological and evolutionary principles to understand infectious disease systems. So in that sense, I'm doing epidemiology because I'm interested in infectious disease systems. But what I'm doing is I'm applying ecological and evolutionary principles. Mostly I do that, or you know, much of my own sort of specialty in it is on the very theoretical end, in that I use mathematical models to try and sort of understand how infectious disease systems work at all, how they evolve, and how one can then exploit that understanding to control the disease. And something I've become more interested in the last sort of decade or so is how to translate those ideas into manufacturing vaccines, making new types of vaccines. So in some way. So epidemiology is, of course, about how disease spread through communities and all that. And that was where I started off. But where I've ended up is integrating that sort of data and the understanding of those principles with some much more fundamental basic biology, and then actually trying to use all of
them. So can you use these mathematical models to predict future outbreaks or how severe an outbreak's going to be?
No, is what I think. I mean, obviously that's completely in contradiction to what the government is saying at the moment, and indeed what's informing government policies. So I think the models that we develop are extremely useful as conceptual tools. They really help you understand form an understanding and of what might be going on. You need data then to try and discriminate between different possibilities of what might be going on. So, and as an example, last year we put out a paper which suggested that at that point in time, we had no idea whether the epidemic had actually already swept through. And what we were seeing was just sort of tail end of deaths, which were lagged, of course, because you don't take 2-3 weeks before you die. And so one extreme possibility was that the epidemic had really basically completely swept through the country almost unnoticed, because it's often asymptomatic or otherwise symptoms are similar to other respiratory infections. And also, actually, there were reports of an increase in symptoms that are specifically COVID-like around February or so last year. So there was a possibility that it had swept through, and that what we were just seeing were the deaths that occurred as a result of that. And the other extreme was what the Imperial College model showed, which was that it had only just started to spread. Mm-hmm. And rather a lot more, the fraction of people who were dying from being infected was much higher than the other scenario. So these are two extreme scenarios. In order to distinguish between them, what you need to do is gather the information on what proportion of the population has already had it. And in order to do that, we set up an assay to look for neutralizing antibodies in the blood of people with. As it turned out, that wasn't as useful as wasn't as informative. But the fundamental point here is that I don't think you can predict what's going to happen to these models.
We are going to get onto the present pandemic and all of that kind of stuff. But just to take a step back, I know that viruses occupy quite a interesting position in evolution in general. So how do viruses fit into the kind of general evolutionary picture, especially with regards to our evolution, the evolution of other species?
Well, different viruses, they're as I'm sure you know, that they're the range of viruses that we live with or that exist is enormous, and you have viruses as diverse as the sort of herpes virus, which is a big DNA virus and has a completely different life history strategy, in that it finds ways to sort of hide in the body. So all herpes viruses cause permanent and chronic infection usually inapparent. Then you have your poliovirus, which is just a little bit of positive stranded RNA. So that there's so much diversity within the sort of umbrella of what we call viruses. So in terms of where they actually came from, there are all sorts of theories about whether they evolved independently or whether they're products of reductive evolution, or whether they evolved through some sort of symbiotic process. But of course, we only have a handful of pathogenic viruses that we need to to worry about for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And while that's a very interesting, but I think in terms of leading back to the questions that we're thinking about now, it is quite useful to try and contextualize whatever pandemic you're dealing with and whatever bug is causing that. It's very important to recognize, to try and place it within what we know about current existing viruses or indeed other pathogens. And I think that's something that's, you know, a real resource for us is, you know, again, coronavirus. We know there are four other seasonal coronaviruses that are co-circulating. And so it's quite useful to locate it within all of that, to think about what it does and also what kind of, how we respond to them. So measles, for example, is a virus that gives us lifelong immunity, kills children, mm-hmm. and that's a very different beast to coronavirus, which doesn't do that. And it's important to think about why it doesn't do that, not only in the context of what it's similar to, but also how it fits into the larger ecology of the viruses that it's similar to, and that ecology is connected, the connections within that ecology relate to immune responses that are shared, really, mostly, because that's, if you think in ecological terms, that's what causes competition for resources. So it's important to think of viruses in terms of their evolutionary and ecological context. I think that gives you a lot of power.
Is that where the sort of, I don't know if this is a silly thing to say, but you know, they're sort of saying that we're kind of due a pandemic every sort of 100 years as a sort of evolutionary thing.
Well, it's not a silly thing for you to say, but it's a silly thing for people to say that we're due another pandemic. I mean, while there could be a rhythm to when, you know, if you think about an ecological system, it is dynamical, and therefore there are certain rhythms within it. But to highlight that, I think is a useful thing for an epidemiologist to do. But to say we are due another pandemic because, you know, it's been 100 years since 1918,
yeah,
is not very scientific.
Yeah, because that was
It has been said quite regularly. So I think, yes, it is a bit of a silly thing to say, but it's a silly thing that you've said.
Like, I've heard it thrown around so much in, like, yeah. movies. They're always like, oh, well, the last one 100 years ago, you know, and it's about time that we had another one. And you just sort of think, well, actually.
Oh, why? What's that? It's like a biblical form of reasoning, I mean.
Yeah.
People are just bored. They're just sitting around. You get this image of somebody just sat there waiting for the next pandemic.
How
long they've been sat there since 1918 or 1919 or whatever it was, just waiting, and now they've finally.
And now it's arrived.
Yeah, exactly. Although I think with, because obviously it's not been that long since swine flu. Really, like, I remember swine flu when I was small. Can't remember. Quite how small, but
2009.
Yeah, so I would have been. I'm actually really bad at figuring out. Whenever I'm like in the hospital or anything like this, I'm terrible at figuring out the. Whenever it's like, oh, I was born in this year, and I'm just like, okay, so that means you're absolutely no idea. So I'm not even gonna embarrass myself.
You've been about 14 or 15 now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, 14 or 15. But I remember with swine flu that wasn't that long ago, obviously, like you said, so not quite on the same scale, but viral outbreaks and things like this, I guess they're not super rare. Like, it's not like they seldom happen, I guess, on such a big scale, perhaps. But what are the kind of key differences this time around between an outbreak like swine flu? Like, I know it's obviously a different virus, but why is it that coronavirus is, or COVID, I should say, is treated kind of so much more intensively than swine flu seemed like it was, at least?
So that's actually a very good analogy, or counterpoint maybe even actually. So very interestingly, the swine flu pandemic, and it was a pandemic in that it was a particular lineage of flu with novel antigenic characteristics which spread globally.
Mm-hmm.
And what's relevant here is that it actually does answer the question that Eleanor, that you asked, that, do these things have any kind of rhythm to them? And yes, they do. And so the swine flu that that arrived in 2009 was antigenically, it was, well, at least in terms of its hemagglutinin protein, it was almost identical to the 1918 flu. So in fact, it had come back kind of 90 years later.
Yeah.
And then the reason it came back is because a gap opened up in the, if you like, immunological landscape, where people who had that particular strain were now dead, essentially. So there was a sort of opportunity for that strain to emerge. And my hypothesis is that the reason why we didn't all die from it is actually fairly, I think, in some ways, related to why we're not dying from this coronavirus, all of us, which is that we have, all of us have been exposed to flu, other forms of flu,
mm-hmm.
and that gives you sufficient cross-immunity to protect you against disease. Not infection, but disease. And that's something that's very, as an epidemiological concept, that's a very important one, that anti-infection immunity is very different to anti-disease immunity. In fact, you could even slice it further into anti-disease, anti-severe disease immunity. Mm-hmm. And so what happened when the swine flu virus came through is, first of all, most of us had some immunity to flu,
mm-hmm.
Which kept us safe. And then people who had been alive around at the time when they might have been exposed to the 1918 virus, and there were a few of them left, were shown to have very strong neutralizing antibody responses to this new swine flu. So what happens with flu, which we are now exploiting in order to make a new type of universal flu vaccine, is that you have certain epitopes, certain regions that are recycled through time. And what we saw in the case of 2009 is that this new virus did have similarities and was sort of recycling its outfit. And people who are alive during the 1918 flu and a few years afterwards still had very good memory recall of those. Now, why did so many people die in 1918? And my answer to that would be that prior to 1918, flu was not an endemic pathogen. You didn't have seasonal influenza. So what you had, because of the way the world was structured, was that you had pandemics that came, swept through, and then died out. So the previous flu pandemic had probably occurred in 1890. And so everyone who was born after that hadn't really had any experience of flu at all. And that's why all these people under the age of 30 died. So these are all speculations, but I think that that's why generally we don't get those sorts of really absolutely awful events where a lot of young people die, pandemic events. So right now we have the situation of coronavirus where this novel virus has arrived. And I think with coronavirus, again, considering its ecology, there are lots of different strains hanging out in different animals. So they probably do regularly kind of infiltrate, as did SARS-1 and MERS, which is actually, MERS is endemic in parts of Africa. But they often burn themselves out very quickly anyway. So I think that's, and then sometimes, on occasion, something like this will gain a foothold. And it could be because, again, something's changed about the immune landscape. Maybe there was a strain like this that came in 80 years ago and people are now no longer, there's not enough immunity to stop it from, or cross immunity to stop it from spreading. But overall, as you can see, you know, most of us aren't dying from this virus. And the people who are dying are people who probably have some, you know, are immunosenescent or have some other condition. Nonetheless, having said that, people are getting very, very sick from it, mm-hmm. who wouldn't normally get sick from the coronavirus. So it is novel, but and we know now from several studies there's a lot of cross-immunity as well from particularly the other two beta coronaviruses that are co-circulating. But, you know, it's a complex picture, but it's important to distinguish between anti-disease and anti-infection immunity. You think of that. And hopefully and somewhat paradoxically, because we have so many pathogens that are continuously being imported from other parts of the world, we actually have, I think that provides a sort of barrier, paradoxically actually protects us from completely new viruses that arrive.
So you mentioned before about your hypothesis with coronavirus, that this may be the tail end of the COVID outbreak and that it may have circulated through the population undetected for quite a while. So does that happen with other viruses that maybe never reach the detection threshold? And I mean, like you were talking about before, if you had antibodies to defend you from the influenza of 1918, they're still effective against the swine flu. What is the kind of population immunological implications of these viruses that may circulate through populations completely unnoticed because they never reach a clinical threshold?
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine that, this virus itself could have gone unnoticed if our population structures were different. I think if, you know, in a population where there are fewer vulnerable people, you might have, it would have gone unnoticed. Imagine, a population where everyone is more or less under 65, which there, of course, there are many populations like that. But in places like India or South Africa, many people are under 65, but then there are lots of people with other comorbidities. But, it is very easy to think of a pathogen which has such a low infection fatality rate in most of the population that it might go unnoticed. And that also the fact that, the illness that it causes is, while it obviously has its very specific characteristics, unless you're really attuned or looking out for them or sensitized to them, you could just say it's a bad flu season. And there are people who believe that, in fact, it's recorded that the influenza season in China and even southern Australia, Western Australia, was very harsh in 2019. So it's possible, that was SARS-CoV-2. The problem is it's very hard to tell right now because the antibody test that I thought would give us all the answers isn't, unfortunately, wasn't able to, partly because you lose antibodies very quickly. That's not to say that you lose B cell immunity, mm-hmm. but you do lose the antibodies decay very, very quickly. So So the jury is still out, I think, on how many people actually had it by the time we noticed what was going on. And I mean, there's another misconception, because it came back, of course, rather very harshly this winter in this country. And then there's a sort of spring wave also that's occurring in many parts of the world. But that means that it hadn't spread quite significantly. But actually, this is where ecological theory and evolutionary, the epidemiological theory comes in. You can actually, once you have seasonality, which brings it down anyway in the summer, it is perfectly compatible with what's going on, is perfectly compatible with it having passed through to a significant extent last year. But now, you know, what we've just witnessed is a sort of catch up of what didn't, you know, the gaps that were there in the, if you like, what the herd immunity, which somehow has become an unpleasant word, the population level, the community immunity levels were, it's obviously heterogeneous. So, and also with coronavirus, because it's not measles, you do lose immunity. So that's another reason why it might come back. This, you know, it was almost inevitable that something, that there would be a significant wave again this last winter.
I know that at the beginning of COVID, like I mentioned earlier, it seemed like some people had just forgotten that viruses existed, and there was a lot of information about kind of, you know, reminding people that viruses aren't living things in the sense that a malaria parasite is living, that it is trying to survive. So while viruses aren't alive, what is the point in an ecological context?
Well, I suppose even, you know, nothing really, sorry, existential answer. Not even the malaria parasite has a goal, per se. So while, you know, there are lots of distinguishable features, you know, of life, if you like, that would, you know, the attributes that we share with malaria parasites, you know. Viruses don't have that agency, and they, of course, they have to hijack, they are entirely dependent on the machinery of the cell to fulfill their goal. So I remember actually thinking about, you know, this leads back to questions of what is life and all of that. So instead of looking at it as why do they do what they do, if you look at what survives, things that can get into cells and make the cell make copies of themselves will survive, will be there. Things that can't, won't, if that's so. But, you know, that, why would they? So you have to think of it, so you turn the telescope around and you say, why wouldn't something that can make copies, can persuade a cell to make copies of itself, why wouldn't that survive? And then the question is, why have these particular forms survived? And it's because they've done it successfully enough. They've managed also to transmit from person, I mean, the pathogenic viruses, or the ones that rely on transmission. They manage to go from host to host. And so, if, again, going back to why wouldn't they survive, it's if they were out-competed by other viruses. And that's exactly what we're seeing now. We're seeing variants arising which are probably only a tiny bit better at transmitting or a little bit better at immune evasion, but they aren't surviving because they're being outcompeted by, I mean, they are outcompeting the original, the wild type, if you like. So because they're just a little bit better at, because as soon as you infect a host and they become immune, that resource is removed from the other strain. So you have this competition going on. And so actually what happens is that something gets excluded, you get competitive exclusion. So it's about what doesn't survive and why it wouldn't survive rather than why it does survive that really informs the whole process.
So really, do you want a virus to not be so, you as a virus, you wouldn't want to be so deadly then, would you? Because then that kind of kills your host and stops your chances of transmitting. So is that why something like coronavirus is just a bit better than like the Spanish flu or whatever, because it's not so deadly, like it only kills off a small, this is sounding,
no,
that's what I'm trying to say.
So, no, that's exactly, that's very, that's, so what the, in order to complete successfully with, or to be the top virus, so it's like kind of survival of the fittest. So in order to be the fittest virus, you need to be, you want to be, you need an optimal level of virulence, which at first might seem to be, it might seem that suggests that viruses would evolve to be as avirulent as possible. But that's not always true, because sometimes some of the things that make you virulent also help you transmit. So a very good example actually is the Myxoma virus that was used to try and control rabbit populations in Australia. So you started off in 1950 with a really serious, lethal, like completely instant dead rabbit type virus. But then that evolved to become less lethal. But it never evolved to the point of becoming something the rabbit never, you know, hardly noticed at all, even though it was capable of it. So in the lab, you could show that you could, if you pass out this virus, it could become really almost asymptomatic. In fact, in the rabbits where the virus had originally been, this lethal strain had been found, lethal in European rabbits, it actually came from Brazil, and in Brazilian rabbits, it hardly did anything. So it had this capability to evolve to become less virulent, but it never became completely avirulent. And that's because it causes, this virus causes sores on the rabbit, and the sores are a source of transmission. So you have the sore, the virus is shed from the sores, so, you know, some fly that sits on the sore will then take the virus from an infected rabbit to an uninfected rabbit. So you don't want to kill the rabbit, but you also don't want the rabbit to be completely, you know, hopping around hardly with a very low viral load. So it all evolves to this optimal level of virulence.
It brings back thoughts of, I'm sure it's not the most rigorous mathematical model of disease ever, but anybody who's ever played the, I think it's a mobile game, it's called Pandemic or something like that. I don't know if any of you have
ever played it. I've got a board game called Pandemic. But
I think there's a board game, but this is I don't know if the mobile game is based off of the
right
board game or what, but in the game you have to design a virus that will wipe out the entire world, and you're obviously fighting against the humans who are trying to research a cure and stuff like that and treat your virus. And anybody who's played that game knows that the best way to win that game is to evolve all of the things that increase transmissibility but don't kill the host.
Yes.
You want to not kill the host for as long as possible. And then once you've infected the entire world, then you evolve major organ failure or something like that. Kill the world. And I think it's actually quite applicable, because I do remember hearing
about that's a fundamental idea. Yeah.
Exactly. The thing with COVID, that one of the reasons why COVID is so effective is that it managed to transmit a lot of the time without us being able to detect it, like asymptomatic transmission and stuff like that. And it doesn't kill that many of the people who infect. So by the game, it's almost the ideal. Hopefully it doesn't evolve major organ failure and respiratory arrest completely and things like that in everybody. So you just got to keep our fingers crossed on that one.
It's not, you know, it's easy. Yeah, they are the same principles. It's not just a similarity. I think that is why in the real world that happens. But in the real world, of course, the game doesn't end. So what the virus wants to do is become endemic and stick around. So it won't go into do the organ failure thing. But and viruses that do that, start off like that, like Ebola, are, you know, much that they normally are controlled because A, you can see that they're killing people, and and also they limit their own success by doing that. So yeah, so fortunately there's sort of inbuilt break in the system, so in that way we could take comfort in that. In the, I mean, one way to reassure people about these pandemics is to say, if something really, really lethal happened, and sometimes, you know, some of these viruses are awful, but I mean, there are a small set of very, very lethal viruses, but they usually sort of burn themselves out very quickly or get detected, and you can actually put in place the measures that we've rather fruitlessly been applying to COVID to seal it off and stop the spread. So yes, they kind of high virulence is a bit of an own goal for them.
It's like a covert operation. Yeah. You don't want to be too obvious. You got to be on the sly, like not too obvious a virus to get detected.
Yeah. I guess that's the thing, though. It's like what we kind of mentioned before about viruses kind of just slipping under the radar, and it does make you wonder, like, how many viruses have never been detected just because there's no need to detect them. Like,
if... Well, I mean, not many people, I guess you guys are in the field, but, you know, I mean, how many people had heard of seasonal coronaviruses, do you think?
Yeah.
I hadn't, to be honest with you. Heard of feline coronavirus, because we didn't
have Yeah.
Even us, being people in the medical field, didn't know.
I mean, yeah, it's pretty rare to have... you know, I mean, people do, obviously there are, there, it has exactly the same characteristics in that some elderly people do die, and a few infant, I think there are a few infant cases. I suspect kids are born with pretty good maternal antibodies to all of these things, and they are actually incredibly prevalent. So you do become positive to seasonal coronaviruses, you know, within the first 5 years of life, you will have had all four of them. And then, but again, unlike measles, first of all, it's not clearly, it doesn't have the same impact effect. And also you don't get lifelong immunity to infection. So you keep becoming, you know, reinfection occurs quite regularly, but that tops up your immunity. And so you have the, it settles just like measles to a sort of endemic equilibrium, as we call it, endemic state. And that's what we enjoy, I think is the right word, with these seasonal coronaviruses. And that's without a doubt where we are heading with this virus. But it's taking longer, certainly, than I anticipated. Not so much in this country. But, you know, parts of the world where, you know, one may have hoped that it has passed through, it's obviously not the case. But having said that, there are often these big countries like India and Brazil, which are huge. So the idea that it would have, I remember, you know, about a month ago, a journalist approached me and said, do you think India is at herd immunity? And I said, that's... India is a big country. Mm-hmm. There are probably pockets that are, but I would not be surprised if there are large parts of it that aren't. And the other interesting thing is that even within the same geographical location, you can have certain communities that get infected and it passes through, and others, particularly because of lockdown, where it didn't reach them. So in South Africa, you had two waves, and the first wave was in what are called the townships, and then the second wave was more within the kind of gated communities, if you like. So, you know, it is when you see a second wave happening, there is a tendency for journalists to say, oh, you know, this is scary, it means it never spread at all, and all of that, but it's not at all, you know, unanticipated within the general framework of how these diseases spread, but eventually it will settle down to a level like all these other respiratory illnesses where you get a peak either just before Christmas or around this time of the year. But because most people will have had it, that they're unlikely to have very severe illness and suffer and die. So, and the vaccine, of course, while vaccines themselves may only offer short-term protection against infection, at the moment we are certainly enjoying that, so that will keep it down. But I suspect infection levels will go up again after the summer, but deaths hopefully not.
So do you think we'll have to get revaccinated then?
I am hoping, and one can only, that going by the other seasonal coronaviruses, that one vaccine will be enough to protect you against disease and death. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping we will not need to revaccinate. But it might be a good idea to revaccinate the really vulnerable people.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a mistake in the first place to try and vaccinate everybody, because most people aren't at risk from it. And but even if we do that, I don't think we'll have to I'm hoping that it won't be necessary to revaccinate, because this vaccine, I mean, whatever strain we use, will give enough protection against death from other strains as well. And it seems to be, at the moment, the data look pretty promising.
Yeah.
I think COVID's been quite an interesting example. Three of us were small at the time of swine flu, but I think COVID has garnered a particular interest from a kind of data point of view. I guess maybe the kind of data instruments that we have now weren't as good back then. But in terms of informing us for the future, COVID, we know that it's not the first global pandemic, and I think we can be fairly confident to say it's not going to be the last either. And especially in a world where that we do have so much travel, but in particular with a increasing global population, increasing global population density as well. Because I think we can agree that a lot of the measures that we've had to take, or we have taken to try to control COVID, often it seems not particularly effectively until the vaccines have come along, are not something that we really want to be happening on a regular basis every single time we catch an outbreak of a virus. So what are the do's and don'ts, do you think, for the future, for future pandemics?
Well, the first thing we need to do is pay attention to the, as you say, the costs of any mitigation strategies. And that's really not been done this time. So, you know, we just jumped into lockdown. Now, obviously, right at the, last year, this time, it was completely unknown beast, so maybe that was justified. But even at that point, there was no discussion about what the harms might be and whether overall we were fulfilling our obligation to do no harm. So that the biggest lesson is that we really have to take on board what the collateral damage is from the measures that we put in place, because, you know, it just goes without saying that, you know, hopefully we won't have anything even worse than COVID, but, you know, however bad it is, you can't do something that's going to make things even worse. So that's really the fundamental message. And, you know, maybe in this instance, we didn't have the data for what the collateral damage was from some of the things that we put in place. But we do now. So hopefully that will be taken into account. I'm not saying, you know, you might, if something is really lethal, you might say, well, yeah, it's worth locking down and keeping children out of school and letting people lose their jobs and not feed their children and letting globally a lot of people die, actually. That's what lockdowns do. And maybe it's worth locking you guys up in your rooms and saying don't go out and not offer first fist. I mean, maybe these things might be worth it for something that's more lethal, but whatever it is, it's just that cost benefit analysis has to happen. The other thing is that we must be aware of, we must allow discussion of other creative strategies. So, for example, with the vulnerable, we knew here that there was a vulnerable population. Could we have protected them better? Because we didn't. Could we have protected them and at the same time allowed the people who weren't vulnerable to go about their business and, in fact, build up herd immunity and, hasten the journey, the reaching that destination of endemic equilibrium? Could we have done that? That's something that I've been very actively involved in trying to get a discussion going on. But that's those are things that we need to consider. And if we do know that there is a vulnerable fraction, as we do with this disease, it might be best to think about developing vaccines that at the moment we're trying to get a vaccine that is low risk for absolutely everybody. And it's very hard because the disease itself is of such low risk, or the infection is of such low risk to you guys, for example. It's very difficult to get a vaccine. If you have the bar for a vaccine, safety of a vaccine is very high, I think, before, and I'm not sure, it's met by what we have now. But it is definitely met for anyone over the age of 50, let's say. And it's, without any doubt, met for anyone who is obviously vulnerable over the age of whatever, 65, or has some comorbidity. So maybe we could design vaccines that were even a little bit riskier, but for the population at risk, and then step back and think about whether we want to vaccinate the rest of the population. Certainly, if you have one vaccine that blocks infection, that might not be a bad thing to do anyway, but it has to be safe. So recognizing different categories of risk and different categories of sort of risk of vaccine or cost of intervention, having that more finely stratified, I think would allow us to move forwards in a more sensible way. And I think those are some very basic lessons.
I guess overall, it's just kind of taking a more pragmatic approach. Like I do sometimes think that, and I think we saw it through COVID, but it's not just like a COVID thing. It's like a general thing. But there's almost like a religion of like dataism, where people look at data and they think like, this is the data, don't question the data, this is how things are. But often I think, especially in the public light, if you go on a Facebook news story and everybody, it just so happens the number of epidemiologists in British society has exploded since the start.
Yes, everyone.
Everybody and their dog is epidemiologist nowadays. But people kind of look at data, and I think sometimes they miss the point that it's not, it's there, like you were saying before, it's useful for kind of giving us like an impression of how these things move, but not necessarily the scale. Or it doesn't, you can't look at a graph and know the whole picture of what's going on. And I feel like that's something that has been a bit lost on people. I sometimes think it's almost compared to like, back in the long time ago when people couldn't read, and the people who could read had so much power because they could tell the people who couldn't read what the book said. And if you can tell the people who can't read what the book said, that means that all the power is coming from you. And we almost live in a similar position nowadays, but with science, where, you've tried to read any meta-analysis on anything and it's a slog. But, we're in a small group of people who can understand these things. And then we have a lot of power to communicate this information to other people. I think it's a very similar situation. And, you know, if you get people, I think, who say that they understand everything about the data in politics or whatever, telling people that they do, then it can be kind of misleading sometimes. So I do feel like
it is absolutely
break that would be good.
Agree that the power of and particularly, you know, sort of you know, you trot out some equations and everyone sort of goes, oh my goodness, very much in the way I think it's very similar to the sentiments that people had, you know, the awe in which the written word or the scripture, you know, everything was held. And the truth is with that power comes responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And that responsibility I don't feel has been met adequately by certainly not the politicians. And indeed, I think, I'm sure, I mean, I wouldn't want to, you know, question the motives of scientists, but I just think that the way in which the whole thing has played out, you know, the system itself, as it's been realized, has created a disjunct between the responsibility of communicating the facts and of the scientific process, and the power that that actually has. And I also think there's been a general disregard for the general public in terms of what they can and can't appreciate. I mean, it's not, you know, we're not talking about string theory here. It is how do epidemics spread, mm-hmm. the seasonality, you know, when people herd immunity, for example, it's not, you know, it's not a very difficult concept to understand. Lots of people become immune, becomes harder for the pathogen to spread. I mean, come on, it's not mm-hmm. that difficult to take on board. I mean, obviously, there are nuances to how it interplays with seasonality and other things. But it's overall, I think there's been a sort of lack of an underestimation of what the general public can take on board. And instead, they've been thrown messages, got to do this, got to do that. It spreads like this. And then there's one very critical thing that I think also, you know, serves as a lesson take forwards, which is that infection and death are not the same thing. So just because infections are on the rise doesn't mean what we want to stop is death.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to get to the point where fewer people are dying of it than are now. And at the same time, we also have to accept that people die. So, you know, there's got to be, it's not been calibrated, nothing, you know, you have to first of all have in view the fact that some people are going to die of this because they would have died of something, and this isn't, it's now joined the ranks of some of the other respiratory pathogens, but we don't want it to be killing more people than is absolutely than that bare minimum that we've come to accept, but the best way to achieve that, to minimise deaths, so to minimise rather than eliminate, is important. Mm-hmm. And the way to do that is not necessarily by stopping infection, because infection itself, first of all, leads to immunity. And we can stop people dying by either shielding them or now through vaccines. So we need to get away from this idea that every time infections get out of control or start stepping up, that we're in trouble and everything, we have to do everything in our power to stop infections increasing. As more and more people are vaccinated, it's not going to be, it will be fine for infections to increase. But that's the critical thing that needs to enter people's heads is, oh my God, just because infections are increasing doesn't mean that I'm going to die. If, particularly if you've been vaccinated, most of the data suggests that you won't.
I think the importance as well of public health, in that, you know, we know now that one of the biggest risk factors for bad outcomes of COVID is obesity, which is obviously one of the biggest, if not the biggest, public health problem of our age. I think COVID brings into light the kind of real world very tangible implications and importance of public health and looking after ourselves and the population. But another thing I thought was like an interesting idea was it kind of came out of the kind of government reforms to the armed forces, and that, you know, the government recently, they announced their kind of new plan for the armed forces, that it's going to be a leaner, meaner fighting machine, with less people in it, more specialized, yada, 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 all that fun stuff. I think, though, what it almost says is that the government doesn't see wide-scale military conflict as a big threat in the future, that combat or conflict, armed conflict in the future, is going to be a smaller scale, more kind of special forces style thing. But all out war, as I'm sure we know, like with nuclear weapons and stuff, is quite unlikely. On the other hand, things like these pandemic diseases could become more common. So during the middle of the pandemic, we had so many issues with staffing at hospitals. It was very clear that the National Health Service was not capable of dealing with something this scale. Why do we not have, like, we have an army reserve, why do we not have a health service reserve that is there to step in? Everybody's out of a job. It wouldn't be that hard to train up people in their spare time as healthcare support workers who can step in and do some of these important jobs when these things hit. I think just general, like, pragmatic approaches to these kind of problems.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more. I mean, what should have happened? I mean, of course, I've been railing about how cuts to the NHS are, you know, fundamentally one of the reasons, or the fundamental reason why we ended up in such a mess is, you know, hospitals were overwhelmed. Well, why were they running at that kind of capacity? I mean, well, why was there no extra capacity for a pandemic? If you know it's coming in every 100 years, and, you know, what are you doing about it? And then over the summer, we didn't do anything. We built these so-called Nightingale hospitals. But, you know, you'll know better than me, but I imagine it would be easy enough to train staff up to just attend to what used to be called traditionally the sort of fever hospitals. And that would have kept the hospitals infection-free, or relatively, would have done a better job. And, you know, about 50% of the infections were nosocomial anyway. So, I mean, I think there was a colossal operational failure on the part of the National Health Service. And what galls me is that the people who were forced to pay for that were the poor and the young. So I think this is, I mean, I'm sure, I don't want to go off on a big rant about it, but I do think it's just unacceptable what happened. And if we'd put the kind of money that we've spent on test, track and trace and all that into having much more resilience in the health service. And as you said, Sam, having, you know, the capacity, the, you know, get Dad's army to, you know, on board when you've got the pandemic. If that's the thing that's going to, if that's our biggest threat, then you have to, you could even train up people to be on reserve, you know, like a reserve kind of force to come in if there's a new pandemic, for which, in which a lot of people will get sick, but not, you need to be in ICU. Set up the fever hospitals where you have the oxygen and whatever it is, but and have people who are trained enough to provide the care that they need, instead of clogging up the ICUs, which, you know, and then releasing them into care homes. I mean, and the care home system needs to see this reform, I think. So all this money that's just been sort of thrown away could have been used, I think, to have shored those elements up. So, yes, I think in terms of lessons learnt and what to invest in, you can't get away with a lean national health system.
Maybe even like, so going off to kind of those like of ideas, maybe even like a one health approach, because it isn't, it's kind of like collaborating, it's kind of like what Sam was talking about, collaborating all different sort of resources and management and kind of combine them together, and then maybe having that as a, I don't know, future service that we can provide for future pandemics. I don't know.
I think as well, we've seen how this can work. Like I as you guys know, but naturally you don't, I work in one of the mass vaccination centres, and I think this has been perfectly highlighted by, you know, COVID management before the vaccines, I think we can, it wasn't fantastic, but since the vaccine rollout has been
amazing in
the UK, it's been excellent. Mm. And part of the reason I think it has been excellent is because this approach has been taken. Medical students like myself and tons of other medical students, physio students, mm-hmm. dental students, every kind of possible healthcare student who they can legally get in to help, vets as well, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know, they're just getting everybody in. Everybody who can possibly be trained to give an injection has been taken in, asked to help out. And, you know, look where it's got us. It's got us to where
we are. No, and it's fantastic. You know, being of an age I've obviously been vaccinated, and it was just a pleasure. Yeah, it was a pleasure to see the NHS working. You know, this is the NHS at its best at every level. You know, efficiency, the attitude, the sort of general delivery, the sort of morale, everything was just superb. Mm. And so we can do it. Yeah, exactly. It's not like it can't happen. Of course, we have the resources to deliver that kind of healthcare, which may be what makes the difference, keeps the hospitals free of infection, allows us to carry on with our lives without overwhelming the NHS, which of course is a consideration. So yes, I think that's, as future leaders, I hope you will make sure that we have that sort of an attitude in place. And also, make sure that sufficient resources go towards having that kind of resilience in the system. And then if we don't, that the costs are not passed on to the children particularly, and of course, the disadvantaged set of the population. So those are things that I would think as basic principles would be useful to have firmly in place. Once we get out of this particular crisis.
Thank you, Sinetra, for coming on and talking.
Oh, it's lovely to see you all.
So it's been. I'm sure we all agree, a very interesting discussion and so topical. I'm just wondering if you have anything you want to plug, anything you want us to put out there or put in the show notes?
We're just about to launch actually a website, an initiative called Collateral Global, which looks at the effects of some of the mitigation strategies, and but both, you know, the negative and the such positive effects there might have been. And, hopefully that will be a good resource. And we're hoping that actually within that resource that it will eventually develop to contain recommendations such as the ones you guys have been making about what we should have in place to prevent or to minimise damage, what other ways we can mitigate. So it's a website to which anyone can contribute and become involved. So it'd be great to have the medical student community and the vets. I'm always worried. I'm worried that my dog, they're going to cull dogs next. And I'm dressing my dog up. I probably shouldn't say this in a podcast.
We can all appreciate Professor Gupta taking time out of her busy schedule to come on and talk to us today about not just COVID, but mostly COVID, and what we can kind of learn for the future from it. I think you guys all agree with me that was a pretty interesting discussion, and we kind of managed to critically assess a lot of the things that we've seen and probably been quite frustrated about.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely really enjoyed speaking to Professor Gupta. I thought it was really interesting how she talked about the different the sort of seasonal COVID, and then also her views on sort of vaccination and how we don't necessarily need to vaccinate everyone. I think that was a really big take-home message from me.
Going off from Ellie, anti-disease versus anti-infection, I particularly didn't understand the difference between the two and how it's like very important for us to understand, especially in kind of like future policies and future management of future pandemics that are most likely going to affect us at some time. And even like how we can handle like the One Health approach and kind of our ideas, collaborative management of or collaborative tackle. I don't know. Cut that part out, but like stop before I start rambling on. Basically.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to, because obviously I guess we've not completely finished with the pandemic yet, but there will be a lot of lessons. We already know there'll be a lot of lessons about how we maybe didn't do things so well this time. But, you know, potentially us as the future of medicine, it may fall on us in the future to deal with these kind of things. And and I think the chats that we had today and the things that we've talked about and learned from somebody as esteemed as Professor Gupta is something that we really need to give credence to and think about going forward.
If you want to get in touch, please email us at inspiredjournalpodcast@gmail.com or contact us through our social media. We've been Ellie, Sam and Natasha bringing you another episode of the Inspired Podcast. Please like or follow us on Instagram, Facebook and Twitter at inspiredjournalpodcast and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Spotify or any other podcasting platform. Don't forget to leave us a review so we can continue to bring you the content that you love. The Inspire podcast is brought to you by the Inspire Student Journal. You can visit our journal website at www.inspirestudentjournal.co.uk to find out more. See you next time.
We're students and we're all still learning, so we appreciate any comments, feedback or error corrections in relation to the topics discussed. All research presented is correct at the time of recording. Any medical information provided does not constitute official medical advice. Consult your own physician with any medical issues that you may be experiencing. Views expressed in the Inspire Journal podcast are of the host and guests and do not represent the views of the Inspire Student Journal or the institutions we are attached to.